This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on location today with the Poet Laureate of the City of Annapolis. Temple Cone is, among other things, a man who brings the beauty of language to future naval officers at the Naval Academy. And he's a professor, but first of all, he is a poet. And here's his poetry.
I dreamed myself a calf bearer last night, one of those giant rope-veined statues excavated from the Acropolis, a brown calf cloak-like across my back. It was the long day of sacrifices, the air filled with fearful bleating, the slick stench of burned guts and black flies storming above the grease flames for a taste. This calf, though, was calm, its fur still sour with morning milk, the pale, swishing tongue, not raspy, but soft as wet cloth on my cheek. Marble steps climbed to the altar in hundreds, infinite but nearing end. I gripped above the hooves, waiting for tendons to tense, flinch, buck, kick. But no struggle came. Amid the ringing knives, I felt only soft ribs sucking in air, a dank hay scent blowing against my cheek. I had 50 more calves to bear up that day. I remember smiling. I must have been smiling, distant, archaic, like the marble statues themselves, whose faces are always the same, shining, from the terrible knowledge that sometimes seems like joy, that it is never their own holocaust to which they go.
Temple Cone, you write like no other. You really take us to history. You occupy worlds that are biblical, archaic, and yet very much of this moment. So we will be talking about how you do that. But how do you describe your poetry?
I think that's a nice way to say it. You know, I teach literature. I live often in the past. I'm reading past words. I'm teaching a class on Keats right now. He's been dead 200 years. And ever since I began reading, I've felt like the literature I read is here, is with me. There's something incantatory about it. And so some of that one poem I just read is an effort to reclaim some of that original energy.
And it is so true. It is that you bring your antecedents into the poem. Because that could have been written by someone in the 1800s.
Yes.
And yet we have clues that it is very much the 21st century. Temple Cone is his name. And I would like to know if you like your own work.
I do, but I like so many other poets' works better than mine.
That's a very modest thing to say.
I have a great fondness for them. But certainly now, poems like that one don't feel like mine anymore. I mean, that one was written a long time ago, and so I'm interested in who the poet was who wrote it, because I can reclaim some of that, but I'm also not that same person.
I don't know if people understand that, but it's so true. You give that like a gift to the world, and then you don't own it anymore.
No.
It is so strange. And you read old poems that you've written, and you think, that's good. Did I write that?
Mm-hmm.
What do you not like about the writing process?
There's not a bit of it I don't like. I love editing. I like the feel of pens in my hand. I like writing. I have a particular kind of journal I like to write in because it's yellow pages with green ruled lines, and I love that.
You are a writer. You are a writer.
Yeah, I like
born and bred.
I like getting ink smudges on me. No, I'll be honest. We talked about this before. Some of the poetry business. Some of the workaday stuff of setting up readings and getting publications sent out, so on and so forth, is I do it, but it is depleting.
Well, marketing is not for us. It has nothing to do with the hydration we need. But this paper I'm looking at does. So give us another poem, Temple Coon.
Okay. So this is Tongue and Groove. Leopard-backed slugs glide along carpets of moonlight, their hidden mouths scraping algae from the soil. It took Plato a long time to learn to call them beautiful. He believed an ocean of sea jellies spawned from one bell, a trillion wasps from a golden thorn, and all creation from a sphere seeking forms like an eye turning to the beautiful. But the llama perched on an Andean outcrop is a miracle, more taken with a patch of grass than the unbarred sky. Its wool is the thousand-year white of glaciers and beautiful. Day and night, the alphabet of birds spells psalms on clouds. We need to learn the grammar of wind to beg our peregrine lord to kestrel the grackles of our magpie souls beautiful. And still I fail to revere wise men as I do turkey buzzards, their boiled heads peering over the book of the dead. By every road I see them bowed together, questioning the beautiful. Perhaps the script of stars is not a language, but a design, and we ourselves are holy timber, waiting to be joined, tongue and groove, to raise up the house of the beautiful.
Temple Cone at the Library of Congress.
Blues Man. After his first descent to the underworld, Orpheus didn't die. The Maenads never tore him apart like an offering of bread. And the story of his head, singing as the river bore it downstream to ocean, is someone's hopeful indulgence in the persistence of song. What happened to Orpheus happens to us all. He wept. He cursed the animals who came to comfort him till the woods were silent. In Thebes he sold his lyre and stayed drunk for days. But the world doesn't stop for myths. So when the drachmas ran out, he found work as a gardener. Kneeling hours in the dirt, he'd talk to trellised morning glories, to the crocus and the daisies. Of course, in time, he began to sing instead, softly and without knowing it, the persistence of song. Then one day, he noticed the flowers following him wherever he walked, and when he looked, they didn't turn away.
Every line of your poetry could be removed and looked at by itself. Every line of your poetry is a poem. That is not usual. That is not usual. That had to take 100 hours. That had to.
Well, that's an older one, so I won't claim.
You don't remember?
I don't remember, but I will say this, and I tell my students this all the time, that I don't push for the meaning of poems. When we started reading Keats this week, reading Ode to Psyche, and I told them I don't care what they think the meaning of the poem is, that there's so many other things to experience in it, and I would be happy to tell them what it meant, just to get that off the table. Because once I start pushing meaning, I eliminate everything else in the poem. But when I say I don't know what the meaning needs to be or should be, I do know a few things about what sounds pleasant to me, what sounds right. And so I suppose at this point, maybe this is experience, I trust the lines will go where they need to go. And I just need to guide the sound and the rhythm through the right channel.
And yet you are a narrative poet. You certainly are a narrative poet. You tell a story in spite of yourself. Mm-hmm. You might have started with flow. You might have started with sound and sensuality. But you always have characters who are doing things, action, adventure of sorts.
I agree.
And I think there's a mountain man inside of you because there's a lot of solitude
mm-hmm.
and thought that is not quickly come to.
No, and I think that's right. I also think, I don't know in contemporary poetry how much that romantic ideal of the single self in nature is treated straightforwardly or with particular care. And there's so many reasons not to. The natural environment is under terrible duress. We know many different things about what it means to be a subjective person. But nevertheless, I do find poems to be meditative work.
And you honor that. You're very much in the school of Romanticism, in the way you start somewhere and end up somewhere else, mm-hmm. for one thing, and the way you honor nature.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everyone should know your poetry. I think I should market you if you will not. So let me tell them who you are. He's the author of 4 books, Guzzle, That Singing, The Broken Meadow, which was the winner of the Old 70 Creek Poetry Press Series Prize, and then No Loneliness, which was the winner of the Future Cycle Press Poetry Book Prize. That's a fine press. And you have had 7 poetry chapbooks. I think I had the first mm-hmm. one you ever wrote, actually. You've had your Master's in Creative Writing from Hollins, an MFA in Poetry from the University of Virginia, and a PhD from the University of Wisconsin in Literature. He lives with his family in Maryland, where he's a professor of English at the United States Naval Academy and the inaugural Poet Laureate of the City of Annapolis. Well, who did you study with in Virginia? Was Rita Dove there?
It was Rita and Charles Wright and Greg Orr.
And I know them. I don't know Greg as well, but I have the highest opinion of Charles Wright. And you know what? I think you've been touched a little bit by him.
Yeah, he's the only professor who ever cast a spell to guard me against the evil eye.
Well, it worked.
It did. We had a bad workshop. I was getting pummeled. And I looked over, and I'm sure I looked mopey and sad, and I looked over at Charles, and I saw him look at me, and then he made a sign with his hands, and he spat at the floor, which apparently is a traditional Greek way of warding off the evil eye.
He was Poet Laureate,
mm-hmm.
and his long lines, I see, have influenced you.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hear something. I'm Grace Cavalieri, he's Temple Coan, and this is The Poet and the Poem.
Listening to the stars before dawn. The mouse makes her bed in the same field where she might die. Lifted upward in a barn owl's claws, a meteor in reverse. Imagine how she sleeps, nose to tail, curled like the spiraling stars. Before the universe exploded into being, astronomers say, it was the size of a cherry stone. But they're mum about the fruit enfolding it, or about the mouth that drank the juice of stars.
Huh.
The derricks over Texas oil wells are like postmodern theorists, pumping dry the ground they stand on, making themselves useless. Appaloosas circle a split oil drum to drink rainwater filled with stars. Today we scarcely agree on the meaning of meaning, let alone of words.
Huh.
Grace means dignify snails to you. God hides in a pistachio nut to me. But let's try to agree on this. There is darkness. There are stars. Somehow one sculls to the end of Finnegan's Wake and begins again. Somehow the goat can digest thistle, cardboard, and oyster shells. Atoms are endlessly consumed and reborn in the bellies of stars. Eat and be eaten, commands the world. Jesus is a wafer on the tongue. The serpent at the beginning of existence swallows its own tail, and from the collapse of stars comes a darkness hungry for the light of stars.
That last line is as good as any line written. That last line is bonkers.
Thanks.
Do you love it?
I do. I delight in this poem. Can this be the poem I talk about in terms of
construction? That. I want to tear a poem apart and tell people just what makes you tick. So tell us where you got the idea, where you were standing, what hit you, what you were reading, and how you did this.
So I got really interested in getting away from that narrative that you had brought up. And I had read this old essay by Robert Bly, Leaping Poetry. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Bly suggests is that what generates poetry for him is the unconscious leap between images, between lines, and that there were various forms that he'd pay attention to and translate that were particularly keen on making those jumps. One of them is the Persian guzzle. But I had always found the guzzle to be a bit of a, it's too tight of a form, maybe a little prim. And so I got the idea to start writing something like an American guzzle that would be bigger and shaggier and have more room. But I wanted to try writing poems that broke away from the story and then just leapt by their own energies. So I started, my daughter was quite young, so in order to write, and I like to write in the mornings, I'd get up early. And I like writing early in the mornings because Professor Cohn is not getting up at that time. Professor Cohn gets up later, and the rational mind tends to be very, very critical of my poems because, you know, Keats wouldn't have written a line like that. John Donne wouldn't have written that. But at 4 in the morning, or sometimes 3, which is when I'd get up, there's no critical apparatus. And so I was free to write all sorts of things. Terrible, terrible poems. But the connections that came up were deep and unconscious. And in a sense, they were from me, but they weren't under my control, which is why I find poems like this one. I really like these because I don't feel any claim on them, and I'm delighted by what's happening. So what organizes this is that repeated line, that repeated word stars at the end of every stanza. But the only goal I'd set out for myself was that between each of these three-line stanzas, there couldn't be any kind of narrative thread. I wasn't supposed to, and so each stanza is supposed to leap off in lots of different directions.
You just depend on the image.
That's right. And I was free to, I told a colleague once, it felt like as I wrote these, I just turned the volume up on my thoughts so that Finnegan's Wake shows up and also, you know, and a commentary on postmodern theory shows up and, you know, various things. And these poems are, I find, very delightful. They don't seek closure. Sometimes they get it, but they're not working towards that wonderful moment at the end of Blues Man or the Calf Bearer poem. They just go on as they need to. And I've found that writing these was a radically different experience, an unsettling, unhinging experience.
But not everyone trusts his nighttime mind as you do, so you really can't teach that technique. Can you teach people to trust their minds?
Yeah, well, here's because I tell my students this, that this is why many poets do drugs or drink alcohol.
Yeah.
It's to deracinate the senses. Mm-hmm. That was Rambeau's idea. But time becomes a way of doing it. And I'll often have my students write something in 5 minutes, and I'll put them on a timer, and I'll have all sorts of constraints. They've got to fit this number of words in and do this and that, and then I'll just let them off the hook, and I'll say, don't worry, you're going to fail, because nobody can write a good poem in 5 minutes. And once success or achievement or perfection is off the table, they just start writing.
What a good teacher you are.
And they always produce beautiful lines, sometimes even beautiful poems from that.
I actually attended a reading of yours years ago at the Middlebury Tavern, and you presented some young naval officers-to-be, midshipmen, who were writing poetry, and you were teaching them poetry. So tell us a little bit about how fulfilling it is to take these people who are full of physics and calc and show them to soften their earth How fulfilling a life is that?
I have a fantastic job, and I would like to thank all the taxpayers for funding me in teaching poetry to future naval and marine officers.
Is that all you teach?
Oh, I teach a range of things, but I always find some way.
Is it creative writing or poetry?
I teach creative writing. I'll be teaching next fall a class on haiku, the history of haiku. But the students, even the most technically oriented ones, they're interested in patterns and structures. And that's an easy way into poetry, because I'll tell them, as William Carlos Williams said, a poem is a machine made of words. And in that, there's no excess. Everything fits. And they get interested, even if it's simply to say, I will make myself an interested person. I don't have to be a feeling person. I'll just take interest in words. And then for the students who do have that, you know, they're in an environment that doesn't necessarily encourage it, doesn't necessarily discourage it. It becomes something they hold on to, and that they can return to, and that is of great, great and abiding value to them.
I know my husband on naval carrier had Simone de Beauvoir, and many books kept him through the night. Mm-hmm. Temple Cohn, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. This is The Poet and the Poem, and we're going to hear some more poetry.
Sure thing. Two Trees. This was written for the twin daughters of friends of mine, and their middle names are Maple and Birches.
Oh, really?
The favorite trees of the two parents. So this is for Agnes and Adeline Potter. Two Trees. Maple. When God spoke tree, it was a maple branched from the tossing winds of his voice that day. Gray bark, delicately scored, leaves like a fox track or a child's outspread hand, and sap that boils and boils away to a sweetness so heavy the tongue becomes a root in the dark earth, drinking snow melt and spring showers. So perfectly tree, so full of shade, we almost fail to notice them till each fall they unfurl in flame. Birches. Call them ghosts, if you like. Call them finger bones jutting from dirt. These trees say there is no death, say the souls for no one's keeping, but breaks open in snowy bark, silver leaves, green shade, season after season. Birches divide into three trunks, the way a woman with a child is herself divided between mother, child, and the strange being they make together, whose life doesn't last a year, who dies at the moment of birth and is raised the next instant as two bodies, incorruptible forever.
I wish I knew how your brain worked, but I'm certainly glad it does. Let us hear from your new book.
So this is from South Threnody, and many of these poems are sonnets or plays on sonnets. This is one called Matchwood, and it opens with an epigraph from Gerard Manley Hopkins. The epigraph reads, "This jack, joke, poor potsherd, patch, matchwood, immortal diamond is immortal diamond." Matchwood. "Believe you me, lightning strikes are God's gravest blessing. The licks a grizzly gives the hiker curled on all fours, the kiss before he's flipped like a tortoise. First the air parts." Yes, it parts. Gnats know they fly through more than nothingness, which is why their wings sing. When it's done, clouds are a black skull you peer through, the thrown bolt of fatal frequency we call credo. Sure as H.E. double toothpicks, you'll know whether to crouch under jackpines that burn or stand in the open like a jackpine and burn. Sparks rise through blood. Breath's dynamo hums. Flagrant prairies sing the sky-bright psalms.
Beautiful sounds going on there. You love the elements, don't you?
Yes, I do.
They're all there.
I love that, and when I read poems, I read, we're reading Keats. Keats is nightingale, the song of that bird, which so many of my students, well, then none of them had heard it before. So I played them a recording of a nightingale. I told, you know, we looked at pictures of beech trees because the nightingale's in a beech copse. And to sort of say that words, there's something Adamic about it, right? That the word is actually tied deeply to the thing. And postmodern theory, of course, points out words are arbitrary, language is constructed arbitrarily. I agree, and I've drunk that Kool-Aid. And yet, sometimes that sense that the word could be the thing itself, and speaking the word brings the thing. Maybe that's the magic of the poem.
What is the title of that book?
South Threnody. So it's a pun on South and Threnody. A Threnody is a dirge, a kind of funereal lament. And I got interested in these voices. I grew up in Virginia, and I grew up in Richmond, but we also had a home down on the Rappahannock River. And there were certain voices and intonations and ways of speaking that I can recall, and I'm sure I've imaginatively reconstructed them, but I don't feel like they're present anymore. And so these are poems that are bringing them back, but they're also saying goodbye to them.
They are in that book. Those voices are in that book. And you take a down-home person and give it the highest locution. So that is what a poet does. Mm-hmm. And that's what other people don't do. And that's the difference. And so we need a final poem.
Okay. All right, I'll give you this one then. Eclogue of the wonder at the resurrection of the wheat. Gonna make them wheat fields shine, coos the sulky spring breeze to her big sugar daddy, sun. Him of the cotton mouth thick wrists and blue teardrop tats back of each coal-webbed hand. They lean against the Dodge, side mirror like a pony's head, nuzzling both for sugar. She, all of 16, he of, you know better than to ask. If this be the resurrection of forsythia light after winter, it'll take her juicy kisses, sluicing the cave of his triple-earringed ear to get things a-going. For he's a brush fire not worth walking 10 feet to piss out, beer belly like a brood sow's, peach fuzz on his upper lip like he don't know to wipe his lips after peaches. Still, this whole shebang's his gig. She wants lightning, wants love, and he's got 10 gallons of kerosene in the truck bed with a sacred hunger to scorch acres of gold into brass burn just for the savage wonder of it.
That is the unforgettable voice of Temple Cohn. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on location. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.